Welcome back. This is part two of the podcast with Oliver Marx and Andreas Weigen in preparation to our show at office20.com on September 5th, 11:30 to 12:15 at the St. Regis in San Francisco, California. Oliver, do you have any question you would like to ask me?
Yeah, you're the data expert. It'd be great if you could just give us a 10,000 foot view of your perception of data wrangling, I guess, or whatever you want to call it. That's fascinating to me.
So data wrangling is an interesting new term I have not encountered before. What do you mean by that?
It's an alien world for me. So tell me, give me a 10,000 foot view of your perception of what makes this modern paradigm around Amazon and all the other large companies that use data so powerful.
Okay. In one of my classes last quarter at Stanford, Colin Harrison from IBM, he gave a wonderful talk about instrumenting the world. And you can find this somewhere on Viking.com, teaching Stanford 2008. And the point Colin made was that when he was born in the 50s in England, there was very, very little data available about him. Mm-hmm. His passport was handwritten. And he went back another 50 years and he said, those days, it was a breakthrough that British Rail, or whatever they were called before they unified, before they broken up again, mm-hmm. Had actually timetables where people had something they could take with them to know when the train was coming. Okay, so in those 50 years, let's say, in the last 50 years, we have dramatically moved in many ways from a data sparse world to a data rich world. For example, at Viking.com, I have a link to my little GPS device, which broadcasts back up to satellite. And then via a former student of mine, Ryan Mason, nice interface, RSS it out to my webpage. So people can see where I am right now. In the spirit of transparency, this, of course, deprives me of the notion of saying, I'm almost there, it's just a traffic jam. If people know I'm still at home, probably even, you know, in my underwear, while they're waiting for me somewhere at a meeting. So the data-rich world has many aspects, and data wrangling, let's call it data mining, that's maybe a term in one of the direction, has really moved the last decade from being data mining, where we emphasized algorithms, to data mining, where the emphasis is, well, gee, what data can we collect? So it's no longer the question, given a set of data, what questions can I ask, what insights can I gain? But it is the question, given a problem, what data can I get in order to solve my problem? So after this preface here, let's think about what that means for Office 2.0. Let's think about what that means for organizations, for companies. Amazon certainly had done a very good job in coming up with this funny notion of allowing consumers, customers, to write stuff to the Amazon website called reviews. So that takes some courage because not everything customers might want to have to say actually might be positive about the product. Side remark, attribution. Is it about the product or is it about Amazon? And I think Amazon is a very lucky position there that the reviews tend to not be about Amazon service, but which is very good, but tend to be about the products. So although 60% of the reviews are 5 stars, 20% of the reviews are 4 stars, so that means 80% of the reviews are 5 or 4 stars, there are some bad ones. And it doesn't mean that if they're bad reviews, it will hurt Amazon's business. Because the customer feels supported in his or her decision-making process by what Amazon.com can be doing for them. So it's again this notion of transparency, of being able to look inside the organization, and in this case even to have reflected what others on the outside said. That is, I think, one important element of what I call data strategy, of figuring out where to actually open up your database and allow customers as well as employees to write to it. Mm-hmm. What a different world from almost everything else. Think about airlines. Think about banks. Think about technology companies. You know, that notion, and I think Tim O'Reilly says this very nicely when he says that Amazon has realized, and so of course has Google, that customers create value.
Yeah.
That notion, I think, has to be a key ingredient to understand that customers are not the enemy, although we might sometimes feel that we are treated that way. Yes, I just paid these $8,000 for the ticket, but hey, I'm still the enemy of the airline because I might actually come and want to use it or something like that. So it is very interesting how we should think, how can traditional organizations whose main business maybe indeed is to make sure that aircrafts don't drop off the plane or don't drop off the sky, how can they participate in having value created by customers for them? Think about creating a secondary market for tickets. You, of course, were thinking, oh, you know, it's against regulation, laws, and so forth. You know, on the time scale for a couple of years, sure. But they actually were consolidators a few decades ago, which bought tickets en bloc without knowing who they were before. And why can I not walk up with some pseudo random number to some counter? And then that suffices as my identification. And then here, of course, I show my passport, or you show your passport. But as long, so I think these models are not as far-fetched as people think. So data strategy means to think about what data is truly proprietary. For instance, maybe, maybe not. Do you want to have the pay levels of employees being public? Should every employee, as is the case in Whole Foods, see how much every other employee is making? Should employees be given a certain amount which they can donate to anybody they want in the company? Do you know something about those things?
Not enough. This is fascinating to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there is a parallel which I've shared with you before about HCL Computers in a very large multinational, which is a similar. It's a slight tangent from what you're saying, and I really want to stay on the data because this is fascinating to me.
Yeah.
HCL very quickly are a very large company where the management have turned the sort of the management pyramid 180 degrees and. Where the executives were formerly at the top of the pyramid, they see themselves as being at the bottom as a service group for the mass of the people working there, which is a very powerful paradigm. And there's two other very quick things I want to share on this podcast around that. It's very, anybody can say these things, but they're actually enabling this in the company in HCL in two ways. One is by having an internal stock market for ideas, where you're given a notional amount of money when you join the company. If you don't spend that money in this by backing ideas in this idea stock market, it's actually docked from your pay ultimately, or a percentage of it is. But more positively, you are in a position to invest money, and if the ideas you back do well, you make money from that in the company. And most powerfully of all, if you float an idea on the stock market internally, and that idea takes off and is used by the company, then you get a nice fat check because you're one of the owners and founders of that idea. And then just one other very quick point on this is they also have an internal trouble ticket system where anybody can open a ticket on anybody. So I could join the company tomorrow and in theory or in practice actually open a ticket on the CEO, and all trouble tickets have to be resolved within 72 hours. So this isn't something that just falls into a black hole. This is a great example of transparency and a genuine will, not just lip service, but a genuine will to make this kind of paradigm actually work in the company for everybody to believe it. And the belief is so critical. You know, we're pounded away by advertising all the time, with people, companies earnestly telling us that they care about us and so on. The proof's in the pudding. You know, we all have terrible customer experiences with airlines and so on and so forth. The good ones are so powerful. You know, you don't tend to hear about them so much, but the good ones are incredibly powerful because they create that powerful bond with you and that brand and that company. So.
Yes, actually, let me talk about the second point you made, the one about predictions, because it's a beautiful example, and I want to tie it back to data strategy. And ultimately, what you're doing is you're eliciting preferences from people, not in a hierarchical way, but in a way where those people think they want to say something, maybe they have something to say, maybe they don't, but they want to say something, where they can participate. And that deeply actually is how the world is changing. That we all have been on stage and somebody asks the question we have no idea what to say about, but hey, we start stumbling, you know, and, you know, coming up with some things, usually not that great. Versus, on the other hand, a true dialogue. So getting people, empowering people as individuals to participate where they want to participate and creating feedback loops, as in your example of the prediction market is the case, creating feedback loops where they learn, when they refine their mental model of what works and what doesn't work, that is extremely powerful. For online collaboration tools, that means that it's not enough to just have transparency. But it's also important to give feedback to people, feedback how their past actions are panning out, and feedback allowing them to guess, to predict how a new action they might be taking might be working in the future. So this prediction part actually is so important. And it's so sad that historically we lived in a time where we lived in a world where feedback was just really unfeasible. When we were children, you know, what can we do? There were not much in terms of telephones, we wouldn't know who to call. Whereas now, potentially, yeah, can be feedback for anything. And that's why we now live in a world where actually technology, very different technologies from the plumbing, but where technologies of aggregating information, of having people discover things they didn't even know to look for, in this knowledge society, knowledge information economy, or whatever you want to call it, where this becomes key. From the communication paradigms, we should actually reflect for a moment on the paradigm shift which Twitter is bringing into the game here, mm-hmm. where you have people, in my case, my username is Eweigand, who every now and then, in my case, once a week, twice a week, find that there's something worth sharing with the world. And what do we mean by with the world? Well, with those people who want to listen in. And that is very different from sending that email to that list which you created. So I think I want to go back to what we started with, namely the relationship between the internal and the external, and show how that is being nibbled away. That I think Whole Foods actually employs three people, I've heard, whose job it is to manage the Twitter communication.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And that ranges from specials and all the ways to dealing with customer issues. So what we had started up with here, saying there are traditional ways which are characterized by timescale, they're also characterized by response expectations. Do you expect to get an answer? Well, from my bank, maybe yes. I have an awesome person at my Stanford Credit Union in Germany, maybe no. Versus at Twitter, where I don't expect anybody to write back to me. But people can listen in. There's a new company called Discoverio, which Mingyao Ng is running, where he says, well, let's take this paradigm seriously, this paradigm of people listening in to what I have to say. Maybe what problem I want to solve. Maybe I want to hire somebody to help me with graphic design or with a dinner party tonight. And there will be people who are listening to us who will say, oh, it would be fun if I can just hang out at the dinner party, or if I can do this project, that would be a fun project. Which is very different from the more formal posting it on Craigslist.
Yeah. Interesting. Very. This is fascinating to me. I mean, not everybody gets Twitter, so apologies to anybody that doesn't really understand Twitter. There is an interesting experiment within SAP talking about the inside of a company where they have a Twitter, I don't want to call it a clone, but they have an instance of something very like Twitter, which is running on top of NetWeaver called Esme, which they're experimenting with. And I believe next week they're actually presenting at the conference in at the EdTech conference in Vegas. It's got quite a lot of traction inside the company, and it's an exciting idea. I don't want to get too deep into Twitter. It's just the idea that people are listening is very powerful when you're talking about a specific project. So Twitter is somewhat amorphous to a lot of people because it's so flexible. So if I'm following Andreas and vice versa on Twitter, we totally get where each other are coming from and we get the context of our tweets. If you are following 3,000 or 4,000 people for whatever reasons, I personally don't think that's feasible. I mean, you can do it, sure, but it's just too much information. It's too much scattered information. The contextual information that you get from something like the ESME project in SAP, I think, is incredibly powerful.
But this brings us back to the data strategy.
Yes.
This brings us back to how the tools are dramatically changing from providing a plumbing, which is for many IT departments a key functionality, and which might go as far as epoxying out the USB ports because people could shove some stuff into that port, all the way to saying, well, new ways emerge. And what we need to learn is, how can we prioritize? How can we rank? How can we create relevance functions of the items we might be looking at? Time, or maybe more precisely, attention, is one of the most scarce goods many attendees of the conference will have. And the role, I think, of new tools is to genuinely take the attention people pay seriously, to not try to rape people's attention, as for instance, some ads might do, which just put a picture of your friend on the ad. Your friend has nothing to do with the ad. But hey, they know they got your attention. Like in the olden days, it sounded like your phone which was ringing. But no, of course, it was a radio ad, which had just a phone in the days when all the phones rang the same way. So I think understanding what the scarce good is and now creating data and letting users create data as well as metadata, which help us with a key goal, which is surfacing those things or ranking those things which people, for their own benefit, for the company's benefit, not for the sender's benefit, think are the ones which they would like to attend to.
There's a fascinating thing here. You mentioned earlier about the guy saying how little data there was in the 1950s and how we're now almost at the other extreme where there is so much data. If we do choose to turn on these feeds with Twitter and whatever else, there is a torrent of information available to us. And actually sort of ranking that is a huge big deal. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons besides the overture business model for the success of Google clearly is that Google had in the late 90s the PageRank algorithm, which looked at metadata, not data inside the documents, but at relationship data between people. And that's the power which Facebook could do, if they were to do it right, of looking similarly, not just about what you say about yourself, but also what your friends say about you, and things like that. So the ranking in search is something we are just so totally used to. If I enter Weigand at Google, then, you know, potentially, whatever, 30,000, 50,000 hits with my name. But the top couple of them should be like my contact information, my email address, where I am right now, and stuff like that. And Google in some way figures that out. So for a search where I clearly have an intention of finding something, we are pretty much there. For discovery, we are not there yet, partly because the objective functions are not as well defined as they are for search.
Do you think that is going to be the coming semantic web? I mean, how do you feel about the semantic web paradigm around this?
Don't know much about it, to be honest. So for me, when we talk about data strategy, it is indeed getting people to help organize the world's knowledge. So there is an overlap, I think, with some of the semantic web ideas. But I think for the communication infrastructure, and as I said, infrastructure for me contains elements of prioritization and things like this. How pathetic that a phone either rings or it doesn't ring. You know, we talked about
binary.
This. Yes. So there is a lot coming this way. And some open questions are, for instance, you know, if I tell my RSS reader, for instance, I'm working with a company called MSpoke out of CMU in Pittsburgh. And if I tell them I have 5 minutes now, would they show me different things than if I tell them I have an hour now? So there's some very interesting UI questions.
Yeah.
But I think to wrap it up, the key elements were that we saw how the boundary between inside and outside of companies gets nibbled away. Not only in the IT way, where people realize that if they have a browser, which they can use to get basically anywhere, unless, you know, some people suppress those URLs, they can be much more empowered to do things than if they're stuck with their SAP software within the company. All the way to that companies now have the ability to listen to the richness of the media, to the richness of what people really are genuinely talking about. And that's very different from old style market research, where you go to the mall and shove a microphone under people's nose and say, what do you think about this product? It's very different from traditional research on, well, what features would you like to see in the loyalty program? Well, maybe some days when I can get a nonstop between San Francisco and Shanghai in business class in United, none in the next year, no worries. But that would be a nice thing to see, to some real, generally true innovation here. Which could be, you know, that you have some idea of who you might be sitting next to on the plane, or as Virgin does it beautifully, that you can chat up with that cute person just a few rows behind you. So the listening of companies, them understanding those patterns in an honest way without trying to screw customers and shoving them another ad which they're clicking up with 0.1% probability, but giving them the feedback, making them understood, allowing them to conduct business with the company in a way they, the customers, are interested in conducting business. So that's a bit of a stretch from talking about data strategy, but for me, I really want to make clear that data strategy is much more than, you know, worrying about whether you buy Oracle or you MySQL. It is really, how do we get people to participate? And ultimately, it's the realization that people will participate if and only if they see that their world will be a better place, will be a better place if they do. On that note, we'll see you on September 5th, 11:30 in San Francisco. And if you can't do that, then we'll have another podcast of our event, and the video will also be available.
There will be video available later, exactly.
Thank you.